Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Aquarist Podcast. I'm your host, Randy Reed. For the pre-interview section of this episode, I want to talk about a few of the DIY projects that I have tried. Now, some of these projects have been absolutely worth the effort because the end result is, in my opinion, better than what is commercially available, while at least one has fallen well short of my expectations. So, for the good. First up was making my own aquarium lids out of clear greenhouse roofing material I bought at Home Depot for $37 for a 2 foot by 8 foot piece. With that one piece, I've been able to make form-fitting lids for 3 10-gallon tanks and 1 75-gallon tank. This material cuts extremely easy when you have the correct blades for your table saw or oscillating tool. I was able to make cutouts to accommodate airlines, power cords, hang-on back filters, and even the hang-on breeder box on the front of my Breeding for Karma tank. This material is incredibly versatile. I've added a simple knob to the front piece on each tank using Gorilla Glue. What's even better is that I still have enough leftover material for a 20, or maybe even a 40-gallon tank. I haven't measured that piece yet, but it will for sure cover the 20-gallon. The second DIY project that I'm quite satisfied with are my tank stands. I followed one of Joey, aka King of Do-It-Yourself's instructional videos for the majority of the design, then added in some trim ideas I saw from another instructional video. Altogether in materials, it was definitely cheaper to build my own stand for the 75-gallon, and it is without a doubt far more structurally sound than any stand I could have bought at a retail pet store. So that covers the two good projects I want to mention. Now on to the bad. I had very high hopes for the LED light system using plastic rain gutters, reflective tape, PVC, and LED rope lights you can buy on Amazon. Now, I followed the instructions exactly as laid out in a video, but the results were far less impressive. I just don't think the LED rope light is powerful enough for my application, not to mention having terrible instructions to go along with a remote control that has a crazy number of buttons. For the price of materials and time invested, I should have just purchased the Nycrew brand LED light from Amazon and called it a day. In fact, that is just what I did about 30 minutes after I realized how unimpressed I was with this DIY project. Now, if you want to try any of these DIY projects out for yourself, a simple YouTube search will give you more than enough videos to choose from. So that wraps up this part of the episode. On to the interview. Today's date is Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. Tonight, I'm joined by Sam Scales, nature artist. In addition to being an amazingly talented artist, Sam also has a laundry list of a resume. He's been a radio host, a club DJ, an art teacher, a consultant for the California Department of Water Resources, and a lifelong aquarist. So Sam, thank you very much for joining me tonight on the Aquarist Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Randy. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, I'm doing really good. And, you know, thank you very much for taking time out of your evening to talk with me. I truly appreciate it. I'm very excited to bring you on the show with again, just the laundry list of a resume of things that you've done in and around water and fish. I mean, it's really exciting to have you on. And then also with your experience as a former radio host, you know, talking about fish stuff on fish shows. You know, having you on here for me to learn as well as I, you know, go on this journey of a podcast. So I definitely appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me on because I do miss doing radio. I did it relentlessly for over 3 years. And I always welcome the opportunity to get back on the radio and talk fish and talk reptiles and talk whatever. Every fascination I have because it extends well beyond the...
Yeah, that's excellent. So, you know, I'm going to do my best to interview you and be a good host tonight. And hopefully you're like, yeah, man, I'd like to go back on and talk with Randy in a you know, a month or so. And I'd be more than happy to have you back on, Sam. So let's get started with how you got into the hobby. What were your earliest memories of keeping fish and just go from there to where you are now?
Okay. To start off, I really... even as a very, very young child, I had a real unusual fascination for living things. So it wasn't really fish that started me off, but I think I, you know, seeing insects, frogs, amphibians, you know, other salamanders, lizards, those kind of things really fascinated me. And I was about 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old, I was really, really heavily into dinosaurs, you know, because my parents had bought me quite a few dinosaur books and, you know, just kind of feeling the water or testing the water and trying to see what I was into. And they were surprised that not only did I read the dinosaur books all day and all night, but I was drawing them, you know, because dinosaur books, we don't have any photographs of dinosaurs dead, but everything in there was illustrations and drawings, paintings, and I was doing the same thing at a very young age. So I started not only my fascination for nature, but also for art before I turned 5. The fish came in as I was exposed to public aquariums. So, you know, that the hobby for fish for me, it just kind of grew exponentially from that time.
Now, at a young age, did your parents, did they recognize that you had artistic ability? Because I was drawing at a very early age, and I'm a terrible artist. So I guess at what point did your parents say, like, man, Sam, like, he's good at this. Like, he's different than other kids.
Yeah, I think they did, because, well, I probably inherited it from my mother, because she was a very good natural artist. I have 3 brothers. All of them are involved in the arts in some way or another. One is a comic book artist, another one's a graphic artist, and the other one used to be an art teacher. So I was the only one that took it beyond and became an illustrator and a fine artist. But my parents knew right away, as soon as they saw me drawing, that I wasn't going to be a typical young artist. I was going to be doing something special with art. So I really appreciate them nurturing that in me.
Yeah, that's awesome. And again, your art is absolutely fantastic, and we'll get into more detail about, you know, your specific pieces that you've done and the commissions. But going back to you as a hobbyist now, so keeping fish, you know, what was your progression now that you've taken an interest into fish? What does that look like, and what kind of species did you tend to favor?
Well, currently I've stepped back a lot from my excessive compulsive disorder of keeping fish. I started off when we first moved to California. I was about just before 6 years of age, and the very first thing I wanted for my own room was a fish tank. So my dad went at about 5 and a half years old, and he bought me a book. It was a book with a brown cover, and it didn't have any color illustrations inside. And it only, like, 1/4 of it was about fish. It was called Encyclopedia of Pets. And the fish section was about 1/4 of the book. But I was just so dedicated to figuring out and learning about every single species that was in that book. And, you know, my dad was like, wow, you know, this kid really wants a fish tank. So right from the start, I wanted to do things right according to the book. So, you know, back then, that was a day and age when there was a lot of aquarium, you know, hobby shops around. As you know, they've kind of disappeared. You know, the economic times make it difficult for small shops like pop fish stores to continue to run. So we have just really a fraction of what we used to have. When I was a kid in San Diego, there was literally a fish aquarium related shop or reptile related shop around every mall. And you'd go from here to there to there. And within 3 hours of jumping, you could go to 10 different shops.
I've noticed that nowadays, as well. It's very sad.
Yeah. Nowadays they're just gone. Yeah. So you got Petco, PetSmart, and then a few of the large independent stores. And it's rare to see a small independent store surviving nowadays. So, you know, I got that fish tank. I still remember the fish I had. The first fish I had was a group of zebra danios. I specifically picked out, at 5 years old, mind you, I picked out 2 males and 3 females because I wanted to have a more female ratio. I didn't even understand the birds and the bees about fish. I just knew that that's what the book said. So,
do you remember why you picked zebra danios?
Well, they're fast. And being very detail-oriented, a lot of people would just see them as a little striped fish. For me, I saw reflections in the stripes. So that's what I was telling my brother. I remember telling my older brother that they're blue. And he would say, no, they're just little black and white striped fish. And I said, no, if you look, when the light hits them, the stripes turn blue. And that, and it said they were easy to breed. So I could produce more, you know, in my mind, I was thinking I could produce more Zebra Danios.
And did you successfully breed those Zebra Danios?
They laid eggs nonstop. I would get little wrigglers out of them. But at 5 years old, I didn't know how to raise little wiggler fish from egg. So they would die.
Oh, hey, but the fact that you got it to wigglers at 5 years old, I mean, that seems really impressive. Like your tank was, you know, obviously dialed in enough to make them feel comfortable to breed. So, I mean, you know, I'm already seeing a very bright future for you in the fish keeping hobby. Sam, as a 5 year old, is having some real good success with these Zebra Danios. So, how did your time in the hobby then as an aquarist progress then from then having Zebra Danios?
Well, my first breeding success was the easy ones. I ended up getting some platies. So I got some live bearing fish that were, as you know, they kind of breed themselves. And, you know, you just end up with babies. So I was able to separate the babies, put them into a little breeding net, and raise them up to a size that they wouldn't get eaten by the parents, and then put them back into the tank. So by the time I was 6 years old, I had a tank full of Zebra Danios, the 5 Zebra Danios, and a bunch of platies.
Very impressive.
Then, you know, fast forward, I kept getting more fish. My, you know, as time went on, my dad bought me a few more tanks, which was kind of, you know, unusual at the time. He was like, "You want another tank?" You know, most kids are satisfied with one tank. And so I'd say by the time I was 10, I had, you know, half a dozen tanks. And I started keeping fish like Central American cichlids. I had some Carpentis, and I had Texas cichlids, the two different, and I what blew people away was I knew that there was a difference between the two. I also had pike cichlids. Back in those days, when you bought a pike cichlid, you just bought a pike cichlid. You didn't buy Crenicichla saxatilis or Crenicichla lugubris. You would just buy pike cichlid, and nobody really knew what species they were. In fact, if you looked in all of the old batch atlases, they basically had like 5 species of pike cichlid, and they all had no scientific names.
Now, were you into the scientific names then when you had these pike cichlids? Were you able to differentiate?
That was the thing. Okay, so because technically the species that I had, which I later determined was Crenicichla, trying to remember, I'm gonna draw a blank on this one.
I'm not gonna be able to help you at all on this one.
Yeah, half banded pike in Latin. I just can't translate it in my head right now. But that's one thing, it's an interesting thing that you pointed out there, that I was into scientific names as a little kid. Zebra Danios were Brachydanio rario. Chinese algae eater, which I also had in that, is Gyrinochilus aimonerii. My platies, you know, and it made my brothers sick. They didn't want to hear it. You know, but my platies were not platies. They were Zephophorus variatus, you know. And so that's the way I was with my fish. And I also kept reptiles. I kept, you know, local alligator lizards that would live around in our neighborhood here. At the time, they used to be called Garinatus multicarinatus, and they changed names multiple times. Now they're Elgaria.
All right. So I've lived in San Diego before, and I know the lizard you're talking about, and I can't stand those things. I mean, I've had a bearded dragon. I've had an iguana. Those alligator lizards, man, those things give me the absolute creeps because they don't back down. Like, they see a human and they will stand their ground and they'll kind of come at you. So I'm personally not a fan of those guys.
They bite and they kind of look a little bit like a half snake.
Yeah. So what are you doing as a kid with those things, man?
Well, I had a talent of making them tame.
Oh,
so for all the neighborhood kids that wanted to have a pet alligator lizard, they would bring it over in a shoebox, and I would tame it for them.
Oh my goodness! You're the lizard whisperer.
Yeah, basically, I would, and I had so many. I had probably like 15 different cages and tanks I had a little patio. And because it was a local lizard, it didn't need heating or anything like that, you know. And so I had a little patio with all these little cages. Some of them I made, some of them I just turned little plastic containers into cages. And I had all different kinds. And I'm telling you, I was like 10 years old and I had all these different, I had the high red strain. So I was doing like reptile genetics before most people even thought of that thing.
Oh my goodness.
You know,
goodness.
Like ball pythons and corn snakes.
And I'm guessing you had the bluebelly, the little bluebelly guys, right?
Oh yeah, I had more than just those. We'd go out in the desert and I'd catch lizards all the time. So I had leopard lizards. I had desert iguanas. I had a chuckwalla when I was about 15, and his name was Chucky. That's creative. And he was about 20 inches, almost 20 inches long. He was about 18 inch long lizard, and everyone loved him.
All right, and tell me you're staying away from the rattlers, at least in Southern California.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's one thing. Okay, I really like venomous snakes, but I'm also very fond of living.
Okay,
and I'm pretty logical when it comes to things like that. And I've had, you know, I'm 4 years old now. I've had a lot of friends bitten by venomous snakes and had to go through some serious hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of them lost things, you know, lost fingers and lost movement in their arms.
Yeah, and for those that don't know, in San Diego, I used to do some mountain biking over in Mission Trails, I think it's called, right? And, you know, it's a common occurrence. There are rattlesnakes out there, especially the worst would be on really hot days. So you'd go out there in the evening to ride, and as it cools down, that's when the snakes come out. And the worst is when you're in a very, very low gear trying to climb, and so you're not going very fast. And you're going uphill, and then you notice that there's a rattlesnake on the trail, and you're passing it going, you know, a half a mile an hour because you're climbing a hill. That is the absolute scariest feeling, thinking that this thing is going to reach out and strike your leg. So there are also rattlesnakes where you're out there playing.
Yeah, I've dealt with a few. You know, a lot of people call me around here. If there's a rattlesnake, they say, hey, can you come and move this thing? It's in my yard, or it's on our street, and they don't want to hurt them. You know, I've preached enough about not hurting them. So they'll call me and I'll just get it and I'll walk it down into the canyon. You know, I use snake sticks, buckets, gloves, and, you know, I just do nature a favor and keep them out of the people's way, and then the people won't mind them.
Yeah, doing a good service to your community and to nature as well, because they're good rodent control as well. So, all right. So you are a lizard tamer. You've amassed a bit of a collection. So let's kind of switch gears into your career as an artist. And so, you know, I want to give you a plug. And this isn't even one that's being solicited. So I actually have on order right now, and I wish I would have ordered it sooner. Epistogramma Hongslowi. I think I'm butchering.
Hongslowi.
Hongslowi, yeah. So I ordered that that art print from your website, and we're definitely going to share the links to that. But it was your Threadless website. It is an absolutely beautiful, you know, piece of art that you've done, and I'm going to hang it somewhere in this general vicinity where I do this podcast recording, so I can have it up on the wall. This is not a gift that you gave me. There's no discounts. I paid full price on your website because I think that this is an awesome piece of work. I almost added the Oscar to it as well, but I have to sneak these things on the wall so my wife doesn't notice that I just plastered, you know, four different pieces of fish artwork in my office / fish room. So I'm definitely excited about that. So let's talk about your career as a nature artist then.
Okay, so I started off, you know, I've always drawn things. As a little kid, my two favorite things to draw were dinosaurs and airplanes. Don't ask me where the airplanes thing came from, and don't ask me where it went. It was a temporary part of my life. For some reason, I was fascinated with airplanes. I probably have not drawn one in well over 20 years. But as I went to, you know, through elementary school, my favorite subjects were fish. You know, I quickly found that I understood how a fish looked as far as its fins, scales, head, proportions, you know, something that a lot of artists in art that I saw, even, you know, adults, the artwork of adults, they didn't seem to understand how to draw a fish. You know, a lot of fish that people draw look kind of like the Jesus fish, just a little, you know, ellipse here, ellipse there. And you end up with a lot of great artwork. Like if you look at a lot of artwork by the masters, they would paint a beautiful mermaid or an alligator, and there's fish in the painting, but the fish looked nothing like a fish. They don't have the right fins, the scales don't look right. And this is something I noticed fairly young. So I wanted to be like this great fish artist. I'm like, I'm going to be a great fish artist. You know, I'm going to be a fish artist and just paint fish. And then we didn't have, you know, we couldn't search online, obviously, because we didn't have the internet yet. But all the books, I would look through art books all day and all night, and I couldn't find very many good fish artists. So I decided probably about 10 years old that I was going to be a great fish artist.
And maybe at best you would find artists that were doing saltwater fish, but definitely not freshwater, like not cichlids, not plecostomus, right?
Definitely not. And that was the niche that I fell into as I got older. By the time I started high school, you know, I went through the junior high phase where you're kind of more interested in like girls becoming interesting, you know, and you kind of fall away from the things that you do, because you're so interested in puberty.
Hey, girls love girls love fish artwork, all right?
So, you know, at 14, I got an opportunity to take a experimental class at a nature center that was opening up. And I was the youngest person. I was not supposed to be old enough. You had to be 16 to enroll. But my teachers put in a word of recommendation because they knew that I was so passionate about my love for fish, and this was a nature center that was on the coast, the Chula Vista Nature Interpretive Center. It just got built, and they wanted to have the best students there, and they petitioned for me to go and fill out forms that allowed me to work there, because it was an intern type class. To work there at the age of 14. So at the age of 18, I became a public aquarist. That was my first paid job. I was getting paid $5 an hour. Minimum wage at the time was $3.25. But I worked for the duration. It was a 2.5 month course through that summer, my freshman summer. And they asked if I could stay and continue to work as a partially paid volunteer. So that was my first job working with fish professionally. That same summer, I started working at a fish room at this guy's garage. You know, he's kind of an icon in the industry, but he stays off of social media. His name is Ron Susi. And he would sell Rift Lake cichlids. You know, some people say African cichlids. I prefer to say Rift Lake cichlids, because we're talking about Lake Malawi, Lake Tanganyika, and then a few of the ones from the Victoria Basin, the Lake Victoria cichlids. So this guy had like fish that I'd never seen before at fish stores. And I was so fascinated. My dad dropped me off and I would just look at the fish. And I could not believe the different types of fish that I was not aware of.
I'm incredibly jealous of your first jobs. You had awesome first jobs.
I was like, yeah, and you know, the my limited access to books, you know, right now you wouldn't believe how many books I have. And it's only half of what I used to have, but I have probably about, I mean, I'm looking at in one of my rooms that has books, about 2,000 books and periodicals and stuff like that. And the other room has about the same number.
All tropical fish related?
Or fish, nature, okay. Plant.
Wow.
But reptiles, amphibians. Just ridiculous.
That's awesome. That's obsession. Very impressive.
So, you know, I had limited access to these books, so I didn't really know the extent of the number of fish out there that was available to have in the aquarium. So by working with this guy, Ron, I remember the company was called SNS Cichlids. He was a real innovator. Trust me. He was like one of the guys that was the first one to breed like, you know, 50 species of cichlids. And this guy said, you know, you can hang out here. If you're going to be hanging out here long enough, you can help me clean up, because it started off with me like wiping the spots off the tanks because I wanted to look at them, you know.
Your and fingerprints.
Like, you can help me clean some algae. And, you know, you can basically work for fish. So, heck, you know, I started keeping reflex cichlids about 14 years old. Maybe I don't think I was 15 yet.
Wow.
And, yeah, that opened up a whole new world to me. And because it was such a fascinating, and it was so new in the hobby back then, you know, they were all kept abundantly in the hobby in the late 70s. And we're talking about the late 90s, I mean, late 80s. So this is when I was keeping fish that nobody else I knew had. And I went from there. So I went into working at a tropical fish store. And the funny thing about that is one of the people I work with now, he's the head administrator for a charter school, specializes in high-tech learning, you know, focal learning of subjects that are non-traditional. The programs that are there are the herpetology program and ornamental aquarium fish program. And this is like no other I've ever even heard of. So I helped this guy. I'm a volunteer teacher there right now. They've been asking me to come on staff, but I prefer to do it as a volunteer basis so that I'm not obligated to be there all the time. But this school has a fish room with over, I'd say, 50 tanks. They have a display tank in the main hall that I had once set up with the people from Tanked, you know, from the TV show Tanked. And so we moved it from Petco headquarters to this school. It's called High Tech High. And it's the only school I know of that has an ornamental aquarium fish program.
Yeah, I'm so not familiar I go there with any of them that do.
I do lectures periodically.
That is very unique.
And the greatest thing, here's the craziest thing about it. The first guy that hired me at a fish aquarium shop, he's the head administrator for that school.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so he knew you from early on and knew your stuff and were passionate about it. So what better person to share it with the kids then?
And I feel blessed. You know, I mean, working with kids is nothing better I'd like to do. I expect my son to be going to that school next year. He's 13 now. He has three aquariums, quite a few reptiles, and a collection of spiders.
So that leads me to my – so on the note of the kids and the youth then, are you seeing a genuine interest then in with these kids in keeping their own personal aquariums? Or is this just something that's really fun at school that, you know, they wouldn't want to pursue outside? Because as we were talking about earlier with the – you know, shrinking number of mom and pop pet stores compared to, you know, when we were growing up, you know, to what's available now, getting the youth involved in the hobby, getting them interested. I mean, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be what continues this hobby. I mean, you know, you go to a fish club meeting and the average age is probably 50, maybe even over that of people in the room. You know, and it's very disconcerting that we don't see more youth. Now, granted, some of these are in the evening, but you know, what's the vibe you get from the kids?
Yeah, this particular group of kids, I'd say about 75% of them have aquariums at home, and about half of those got aquariums because they got involved in this program.
Oh,
now
excellent.
Some of them have parents. We're into it also, so you know, so that helps.
Yeah, no, that's promising though.
It is. You know, San Diego has one of the oldest aquarium clubs in the whole U.S., the San Diego Tropical Fish Society. Mm-hmm. But there have been a lot of questions about, like, the average age of the members. You know, they've tried a few different things to get younger people in there. But there's been, like, some people saying, well, I think we have the same guys here. You know, every auction is the same types of fish, the same plants. And we need people with a broader interest level to stimulate, like, more people to come to the meetings. So up north of us in Orange County, there is a club called Coast, and they have more of the high-level aquarists that are members and members there. And you'll see some of the younger people there. We're talking about a lot of rare cichlids. And then they book higher level speakers there, such as Rusty Wessel, Paul Lozelle.
Oh, so very, very famous in the hobby. Well known.
Yeah, you know, so these are some people that really brought us a lot of the books that we have and a lot of the species we have in the hobby.
Are they doing good stuff to also help encourage more youth in the hobby as well?
You know, both clubs are trying. It's not for lack of trying that it's not happening. I just think right now one of the biggest concerns I have with the hobby is that younger people have a lot of distractions. There's a lot more things that they can do. Social media, I mean, half the kids I know, you know, you see them sitting on their phones all day.
Yeah, that's definitely a concerning trend as well. And, you know, a previous guest that I had on the show, Brendan, a 14-year-old up in Canada, you know, that's one of his complaints of his classmates, rather, and his friends, that they would rather play video games all day long than to take care of a fish tank. But, I mean, this kid is just absolutely passionate about it. His dad got him a 10-gallon tank with some guppies when he was real young, and that hooked him. And I asked him, you know, are you trying to convert any friends? And he says, yeah, he's trying to convert a couple right now. And he thinks he's close to one of his buddies, converting them over to be a fish fanatic. So if that happens, I told him to give me a report back and kind of what his strategy was. And we'll disseminate that information. So we'll see if we can't convert some more kids over.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I just I was excited this past Christmas because my nephew, who's 12 years old, is a little bit younger than my son. He, you know, asked me about getting an aquarium. And so I helped him to get all the things he needed. And so what he got, instead of getting your typical things that most kids get for Christmas, he asked everyone for different parts of the aquarium. So he got, you know, the aquarium, the heater, the lighting, and my mom got him some fish and plants for his tank.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was pretty interesting.
So Sam, I've actually kicked around this idea. Now you're going to be closer to this person, so I'm going to task you with this mission. So you need to get one of the Kardashians to start up a 10-gallon tank, throw in some cherry shrimp in there, and throw some zebra danios or some other cool fish, get it aquascaped, and then have them Snapchat or tweet about it. And I think we will have droves of teenagers and young adults and probably old adults as well wanting to get into the hobby. So all the local fish stores will have to brace for this onslaught of customers. But that is your mission. Get one of the Kardashians to keep a fish tank and tweet about it.
It's funny because I don't know any of them personally, but I do know people that know them personally. So there is 2 degrees of separation.
Yeah, there you go. So not quite the 6 or 7 degrees with Kevin Bacon, but hey, you're even closer. So yeah, you're in Southern California, man. You and your buddies, make that happen. Let's get more people into the hobby via the Kardashian effect.
And there's also the tanked effect, you know. So I'm very good friends with Brett and Wade, who do Animal Planet's TV show Tanked. I've been on a few episodes. And, you know, I hang out with them every time I go to Las Vegas.
Oh, that is excellent. I'm going to have to go back and look for you in those episodes. Well, maybe you're in the background.
I'll let you know which ones later. I'll give you links or something. But the interesting thing is how polarizing they can be. You got half of the hobby who are a little bit elitist, and they just want to criticize everything about the show. They want to criticize, you know, the way they do things. They basically want to criticize a 1 hour show that actually takes many weeks to film. And, you know, having been on set, I know that not what you're seeing on TV is not what is actually happening for the builds. The good thing about it, though, is that they do a lot of exposure of aquariums to people that may have never even thought about it.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge point. I mean, it's, you know, it's publicity one way or the other, whether you like their personalities or not. And the same thing with YouTube as well. Maybe somebody that never kept a fish tank stumbles onto one of the YouTube personalities. You know, they may have, that really over-the-top YouTube personality, or they may be the kind that's just real laid back as they go through their videos. But, you know, exposing somebody that doesn't keep fish tanks to that and sparking their interest, you know, that's really important. And that's how, you can get somebody back in the hobby. And I think, you know, for me, I got back into the hobby just because we went into a pet store to look at some rabbit food or something. And seeing, you know, one of the small nano tanks that was aquascaped, it just rekindled my passion for the fish tank. And then I had to start crafting, you know, how am I going to convince my wife to let me get my small tank? And then the rest, like I said, is history from there. Now I've got multiple tanks and, you know, hope to continue to grow the armada of glass boxes with fish and water in them.
You know, back in about 2005 or 2006, I was managing a store during a time that we were going through kind of a recession. And the people stopped buying these big tanks. You know, the main business for the shop was, you know, 350 gallon reef aquariums and, you know, advanced systems. And they would, you know, sell systems for anywhere from, you know, $800 to like $20,000. But they counted on having a few sales a week to stay in business, and they were failing. So, you know, the money was going down really fast, and I had just started working there. But being as a devout hobbyist as I was, I knew that hobbyists would not give up what they love because they couldn't afford it. I mean, it's like any addiction, you know, people still want to have fish. So I really shifted everything over there. You know, at the behest of the owner, I shifted everything over to nano tanks. I literally, on my own, just, set up a whole section just for nano this, nano that. And I knew about nano tanks because I'd been doing nano tanks for many years before that, but, you know, it wasn't a craze yet. And so I was the first one to bring to San Diego all the freshwater shrimps. And the tiny fish like Boraras and Microcorydoras and Aspidorus, tiny Harak fish, pea puffers. So I brought in all these rare fish into this shop, and it really survived a period of time where it could have went out of business, and it became the most profitable store in the region.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I mean, I've got no macroeconomic data points of, you know, fish tank sales receipts, but it seems like having that 50-gallon plus tank in the living room with your Oscar and your giant Placostomus. Now, nothing against the Oscars, but that was, you know, kind of an 80s and early 90s, maybe even the, you know, early 2000s trend. And, you know, we almost kind of scoffed at the small tanks, right? Like, come on, you can't have a small tank in your living room. You need a 100-gallon tank with, you know, three gigantic Oscars. You know, you put your finger in there and it wants to bite it, you know, like that was an American tank, you know. But now you're just seeing how absolutely beautiful and amazing these smaller tanks can be. I'm not sure, maybe you need to inject a little CO2 and do liquid ferts and all that good stuff. But I mean, you can have some just absolutely gorgeous aquascape tanks and have, you know, 10 neon tetras and some of those, you know, other small fish in there. And it is an absolutely stunning, maybe more so than, you know, a tank that we would have seen in a typical house in the 80s.
Yeah. And, you know, my late friend, I'm sure you're familiar with him, Takashi Yamane. Mm-hmm. He basically reinvented the nature aquarium, and he turned it into, you know, of an art piece, a living art piece. And so many people followed in his footsteps. And from there, it branched out. I'm part of a coalition of international aquarists who promote biotope aquariums. Some of my friends are in Europe, all over Europe, and I'm basically the only main person from the U.S. as part of this group. We have a Facebook page on Facebook, obviously. It's called Biotope Sticks, and we created a system of types of aquariums called the B system, the biotope system. And some of them follow strict biotope rules that, for those of you who are listening that don't understand what a biotope is, that basically it's a slice of nature, how it would be in the wild if it was undisturbed. So you know, some of them follow the strict rules of all fish from one specific niche in a specific river in a specific region. Others are more like fish from one region, or fish and plants from one region. Others are fish and plants from one continent, you know, and they all have their different classifications under the B system. And it's a growing trend. And one of our good friends, you may be familiar with him. His name is Heiko Blaher.
Yep, I've heard the name.
So he's a good friend of mine, and he produced a book recently called Blaher's Biotopes. Really instrumental in introducing like hundreds, if not thousands, of species to the hobby. And, you know, like anyone that becomes an icon in the hobby, he has people that don't like him, and then there's a lot of people that really, really do like him and appreciate what he does. And so his book, Blaher's Biotope, is absolutely phenomenal. It's a big book, and it helps to make it easier for people to create, you know, region-specific aquarium sets, so they can feel like a public aquarist. You know, they can feel like they have a public aquarium in their home, rather than just a tank that's novelty, that's just full of fish from all over the place.
One more time, what was that Facebook group name again? You cut out a little bit when you said it was Biotope.
Biotope Aquaristics.
Okay, Biotope Aquaristics. So I will link that as well. That'll be something that I link in the show notes, so people can check that out. I will say, so one of the future tanks that I want to do, I don't have it. I don't have the tank yet or know what I'm going to get, but I know I want to do a much better job at aquascaping. And so for me, I definitely want to check out this Facebook group. But I've also recently purchased Karen Randall. She came out with a new book, The Sunken Gardens. So I'm about a quarter way into that book. And I just want to, I'm just trying to absorb as much as I can of good aquascaping principles, and really take in a lot of good content, so that as I do my next aquascape, this will actually be my first and true aquascape, as opposed to just throwing some plants here or there and hoping everything goes well. Like I, because me, my personality, like I'm just so impatient. I always want to go now. But this next tank, I really want to do it justice, and I want to take my time. And so, yeah, I definitely want to check out the Biotope group that you're talking about on Facebook, but continue to read the Karen Randall book. And I don't know if you've added that to your library or not, but so far I'm really enjoying it. I'm really enjoying it. Yeah, it's like called Sunken Gardens. Absolutely beautiful color photos in there. So far, she's, you know, does a great job of walking through some of the beginner principles, which for me, you know, definitely a beginner here, so I can really appreciate that.
Yeah, she writes good articles, you know, so I could assume that her book is going to be a great book.
Yeah, definitely. So let's go back to your artwork now. So I'm looking at, I'm going through your fine art prints on Threadless. I'm also checking out your Facebook page. So you said you finally just got around to completing your Dovi. So that guy is looking pretty awesome. Was that a commission or is that just one that you've been wanting to do for a while?
Well, I've had a lot of people ask about it. So the original is actually, it's still available at this point. But a lot of people have asked, do you have a print of a Dovi? You know, and the Dovi, they also its cousin, the Managuense. You know, I have a half-hearted art piece of Managuense where it only shows his head. That's what I mean by half-hearted. And I do plan on doing a full body image of the Managuense. And the Dovi, though, a lot of people were asking about it, and I was like, I don't have one. I wish I had one. And so literally for years, I've been putting it off. And, you know, I started one a couple years ago. I started, like, with the body outline. And then I think I painted over it because somebody wanted something else. And I said, I'll just use this. And so I painted over it. And then it's just on a whim. I'm like, you know what? I really need to do a Dovi. So it's a good thing I did. There's a lot of people requesting the print. Just so the listeners know, you can either buy prints through my Threadless site, which they do print on demand. They have bigger sizes. They have print on canvas. They have print on other materials as well. But you can also buy, if you want, open edition prints. I do smaller prints directly from me. So if you go to my Facebook page, you can message me there and you can buy directly from me.
And your Facebook page is facebook.com and it's Sam Scales, S-C-A-L-Z. And again, that'll be something that I link in the show notes for people to check out. And if you've never...
Actually, the one you want to go to is not Sam Scales. It's going to be Scales Nature Artist.
Ah, okay.
So I have it.
I need to check that out.
I'm unaware that you weren't on that other page yet, so...
I think that's a problem with social media, though. You have so many between all the different platforms and having a page versus your own personal, Facebook profile. I mean, there's just so many that you have to keep track of. So I'm going to check that one out. But yeah, that the Dovi, that's where I saw. I was on your Sam Scales one. So one more time, that other one is Scales Nature Artist.
Yeah, it would be www.facebook.com/Scales Nature Artist. And just so everyone knows, you have to spell Scales, S-C-A-L-Z.
Okay, and so the Dovi is also up on there. And some of your more recent ones, mm-hmm. It looks like a beautiful koi and an arowana as well. Really colorful arowana.
Yeah, that was a little exaggerated rainbow arowana, but I always wanted to do a little exaggerated arowana.
No, it's excellent. And I think, again, listeners, please go and actually check out Sam's work. My descriptions are not going to do it justice, but a lot of your artwork, you have it in a natural setting. It's like the Dovi, it's against, fallen branches in the water. You've got wonderful lighting going on, so it's very much in its element. But then you also have a style where you just kind of take the fish and put it in this, put it against a white background. So like with that rainbow arowana, just the color just really pops, and definitely a different take on your style. But the fact that you can kind of, do the nature scene and then also do this other more artistic interpretation, if you will, I think that's, really telling of your ability as an artist to be flexible like that.
Yeah, I like to try different things. I never know exactly what people are going to want. I personally like to do the whole background, but for the purpose of printing on apparel, so if you go to my Threadless site, you can also buy on a lot of my artwork on t-shirts and sweaters.
Throw pillows and, as well.
Notebooks, everything like that, mugs. So sometimes the portrait style, which excludes the background, works better on those items.
So let's say let's say I wanted to commission you, right? Like, just to give people an idea of the process. So I've got some really beautiful, we'll throw it out there, Bosmani rainbows. And I would want you to paint or to draw, paint or draw. I don't know which one's the correct term for your artwork. But to create, a male Bosmani rainbow just in full flash displaying color. You know, do I need to send you a picture of that? Or, you know, is it just, I can message you and say, hey, Sam, this is what I want. I want it in a natural setting. You do your thing. I mean, kind of walk me through that process.
Well, you're in luck. I actually just painted, last year I painted a trio of Bosmani rainbows, two males and a, you know, fighting over a female.
Oh, nice.
I was inspired by my friend Martin Lucer, who studies the wild Bosmani rainbow, which is very in peril, where it is found naturally in the Armayu Lakes. And I was inspired by some of his photography and videos, so I painted a trio of those. So basically what I do for a client is I ask, hey, you're interested in artwork? First of all, I'd like to know what size you're interested in. And the typical sizes I work in are ones that will fit into a ready-made frame. And it just makes it easier for the client than having to buy a custom frame. So it's 8x10. I mean, I can go as small as 5x7, but you can go 8x10, 11x14, 16x20, 20x24, or 18x24. And I can also paint on canvas, but the majority of my work that I do right now is going to be watercolor and gouache on heavyweight paper. So I asked the client, you know, what size they're interested in. And then we break it down into like, what style do you want it? Do you want a full background? Obviously it's going to cost more if I have to, you know, go into the background. And then how many different species are going to be in there? I like to know what kind of pose they want. Some people just want a scientific illustration. They just want the fish, just like you see them in books, you know, just sideways, looking dead. and they just want to hang that up like a trophy on their wall, like, this species is one I like. I prefer to make my illustrations look alive to the extent like flaring their gills, opening their mouth, appearing to look at you. So once I know what they want, then I'll ask specifically if they have any references. Most of the time, people are pretty open. They're like, you know what? You know what's going to look best. Just do it your way. I trust you. And they'll put a deposit down and then pay the difference when I'm finished with the work. Sometimes, though, they want a specific fish. So if you want a specific looking fish, say if you wanted a dovii who is more gold and you have an idea what you want it to look like, I appreciate sending references. If you want one that's more blue, same thing. So you want the fins up, you want the fins closed, you want the mouth open. I need to know those details. I want the customer to be happy with the piece. They're going to have an original piece of art. I'm extremely affordable for what I do. I believe in, you know, not overpricing work. I have sold stuff for quite a bit of money through some of the galleries that represent me. But when I'm working with people directly on commissions on Facebook, I am more than happy to work within their budget. If they want something with a little less detail, I can easily work within whatever budget they need, you know, to be able to afford it. The other option, of course, is if you can't afford an original, and I do have prints of the species that you want, I've done well over species of cichlid and you know, over the years, and I probably still have about 200 species available in print form, so you can always buy prints and it's much cheaper that way.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to get you know, offline. We're gonna have to connect on those species, and I'm probably just gonna ping you offline and say, hey, you know, do you have this, dig through your library, and I think I want to pick up some more prints from you, because I mean, your work is really awesome, and I can't say how excited I am, you know, enough for the print that I have coming of the Epistogramma. And then also, you know, again, this Tiger Oscar, man, he's just looking at me. He's just looking at me. He says, "Hey, remember the good times you had when you had an Oscar? You need to put me on your wall."
You know, sometimes the species that we tend to forget about, like, I think there's a lot of aquarists that become, like I said earlier, elitist. And then the things that they grew up with, they forget about how much they love them. Oscars are one of those fish that gets thrown away, you know, as far as it's not a cool fish anymore, you know, because I got a rare fish or, you know.
And Petco sells it, right? Petco sells Oscars. I don't want that. You can get them at Walmart.
Yeah, exactly. If it's not on the CARES, you know, conservation list, or if it's not something that's rare and cool or trendy, then they don't want it. But, you know, I the soft spot for convict cichlids. I love convicts. I don't care how easy they are to breed. I love Oscars. How can you deny the beauty? If an Oscar was rare, if it only was introduced into the hobby, like, last month, everybody and their grandmas would want one.
they're beautiful fish. And, they really are.
And a personality that you just can't beat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, they get to a large size, but they're not, you know, they're not so large that, you know, 100 gallon is going to hold two of them. And if you're doing some frequent water changes, you can go down to 75, I would say, with some other fish. I mean, I kept my two Oscars with clown loaches and a pleco. And I mean, that was an awesome, I think that was a 125 that I had, those fish in. And I mean, I love that tank.
That's awesome, man. That's the kind of tanks I remember being totally enthralled by growing up. When I kind of a tank in a fish store,
mm-hmm.
It was amazing. I remember the first albino Oscar I saw. Everybody wanted this fish, and it was $2,500.
Whoa!
And they just weren't in the hobby yet, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's crazy. Time flies, and you know, just like albino leopard geckos, albino Burmese pythons, you know, they once you start breeding things, they all go down in price.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll try and time capsule this conversation. We'll come back in 10 years and we'll see what the zebra pleco is going for.
Right? Yeah, it'll probably be common.
Yeah, it's like that Petco started carrying that thing about a couple months ago. It's down to $6.99.
Good, yeah,
times. 50% off. Yeah. All right, Sam. Well, you know, thank you very much again. I can't stress how much, you know, I'm enjoying your, just looking at your artwork, how excited I am to get the Epistogramma print. Looking forward to getting, you know, checking out what else you have, the artwork that I can put on my walls. You know, I'm not a huge art connoisseur, but I can definitely see the beauty in the work that you do, and you know, having such a strong passion for keeping fish. Any aquarist out there, anybody listening to this, you should have at least one piece of Sam's artwork up on your wall or on your desk somewhere framed. You just do really, really excellent work, and you know, as you can tell throughout this conversation that we've had, that you are an aquarist, you are a hobbyist, you're passionate about this, you want to grow the hobby, you want the youth to be involved. So support Sam as an artist. You know, pick up some of his artwork because you will not regret it. And if you regret it, email me. I'll buy it off you. How about that? Because I'm sure that I will like it. So, and you'll like it too. So Sam, thank you very much for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it. And I definitely want to have you back on the show again in the future.
Anytime, man. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you, and, you know, hopefully we can talk about any specific subject you want. I delve into so many topics when it comes to the aquarium hobby that I don't know if I could find a subject that I don't like.
Yeah, no, that sounds good, man. Challenge accepted. Let's do it.
Awesome.
You have a good night now.
Good night.
Thank you again, Sam. You are a great steward of our hobby and are doing great work to educate the youth about fish in general. I would encourage everyone listening to check out Sam's artwork on his Facebook or Threadless page. I will link those in the show notes for you. I challenge you to peruse his offerings and try and find something that you don't like. As always, you can contact me on any of the Aquarist Podcast social media accounts through @AquaristPodcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or just an old-fashioned email to aquaristpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening. Please like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your fish nerd friends. I truly appreciate it. And I think my new exit line will be this. Get involved in your local fish club, help grow this wonderful hobby, and have fun with other fish nerds. Thanks for listening.